ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Sorry? What am I doing? I'm frying an egg. Oh. Oh, right. Yes, I see what you mean. Chicken, egg. Yes, you have a point. I'm Jonathan Green, and this is Every Bite from ABC Radio National. It's all about food and the places where food, culture, science, and history collide. This week, which came first? An ode to the egg. Ed, which came first, the chicken or the egg?
I had that very conversation with my son this weekend, actually. He was convinced that the egg came first, but then when you questioned how the egg got put on Earth, he was a bit stuck. So, in short, nobody knows. But let's say eggs. Let's say eggs for the sake of this programme.
Ed Smith is a London-based food writer whose latest cookbook explores the deliciously substantial oeuvre of the earth. It's called Good Eggs, over 100 cracking ways to cook and elevate eggs. So, what leads a culinarian to commit an entire cookbook to the egg? A book in which eggs are not just a functional ingredient, but star of the show. What was Ed Smith's formative encounter with eggs?
Eggs have always been there in the background, and I don't know whether there's something formative, although I have fond memories of a particular egg cup. I've got three brothers and we each had our own egg cups. Nothing special at all about them, but I think if I saw it now, I would grab it for the old dippy eggs. And also, I suppose the opposite side is my dad's scrambled eggs, which probably a product of the 80s, were done in a microwave until completely solid and then just chopped through with a knife. So bouncy and pretty gross, to be honest.
That didn't put you off?
No, weirdly. I mean, he only cooked about two things. And so maybe, again, it's something I look back with fondness.
The egg is an extraordinary thing. I mean, it's in that sort of pantheon of miraculous food chemistry. The egg has a great range of roles. It does a lot of very magical and mystical things.
It's amazing, isn't it? I think there can't be many cookbooks that don't have eggs in as an ingredient, whether they're used whole or... I like how you sort of separate the yolk and make emulsions and mayonnaise and things like that. And then the whites do these amazing thing where you whip them up and they become foamy and stable and help cakes to rise. And it's pretty amazing. And also, I think, what's that saying? Everything's better with an egg on it.
Do you have a sense of what's going on chemically with those things? Like when we whip egg whites,
yeah,
what happens?
So you're incorporating air into the... I'm not going to pretend I'm a scientist, but ultimately they are able to hold the air in little bubbles and pockets, aren't they? And that can expand with the right amount of heat. That those bubbles can continue to expand, and if it doesn't get too hot, and if you've got other ingredients in the cake or whatever you're doing, then they also won't collapse. Yeah, I think it's amazing.
But it is one of the most remarkable transitions in food, I think, that we can take something like an egg white, that viscous...
It's not appealing, is it, an
no,
egg white to start with?
That's right.
It's kind of like an alien substance that if you put it in your hands, it will drip through like a real gloopy sort of thing, and then suddenly it becomes a souffle.
Extraordinary.
Yeah, and also when you keep it whole as well, the number of things that you can do to it just as an egg, so obviously a fried egg, but then that's quite different to scrambled eggs or quite different to a poached egg. Each of those, the whites and the yolks, cook at slightly different temperatures, so some of it's molten when the rest of it's hard. Yeah, it's a good thing.
And it's a thing, of course, which divides opinion significantly. How one likes one's eggs,
yes,
is a very distinct personal preference.
In my book, Good Eggs, if you want to know how I fry an egg, I've written a few words on it, but the recipes that involve fried eggs is, you know, fry the egg as you prefer, in the fat that you want to fry it in. I mean, I have my preferences, but who am I to suggest that someone who likes the yolk flips over and hard is wrong? I mean, I think they are wrong, but if that's what they want to do, then go for it.
Objectively, yes, they're seriously in error. But you've whet our appetite. Tell us your preference.
I think my preference is for a fried egg, crispy at the edges, completely molten in the yolk, which means you've got to cook it, I think, in a cast iron or a stainless steel pan, not a non-stick one. They tend to be like hotel-y. You know, if you go to a hotel buffet and they're all like shiny and slippery, that happens on a non-stick surface. But if you've got that kind of slightly different metal where the fat sort of bounces off it and gets hotter, get crispy edges, and then I turn the temperature down so it doesn't bubble and spit, it's hot enough to be able to baste over the top and to get crispy edges, but inside the yolk remains completely runny.
It's almost a rule of a certain kind of cooking to have that crispy extremity and then something a little closer to raw in the interior. I'm thinking of a steak.
Yeah, exactly. The crusty bits of the Maillard reaction and the browning, so there's also a bit of flavour there, I think. And egg's quite a neutral ingredient. I guess we might talk about that as well, because it holds other flavours or can be embellished. But fundamentally, it's quite neutral. So maybe the textural thing is pleasing. But equally, like, you know, the textural, I like a scrambled egg that's quite runny rather than stiff and turgid.
That is a subject of some domestic dispute in my household.
Who's for what?
I too am a ruddy scrambled egg aficionado. Not so much my better half, but that's another tale.
Well, you know, it doesn't take long to do either version, does it? So
no.
I guess you can meet in the middle.
Yeah, well, and you can, I think, cater for one and then the other sequentially with not much fuss.
Exactly.
Take us to the flavour of the egg. It's an interesting point you raise, that the egg is a cipher.
Yes. A good yolk, I do think you can taste the quality of a yolk. Mm-hmm. What that flavour is, despite saying I'm a food writer, I'm not sure I know what that flavour is. Sort of custardy, without the vanilla, if you think of that.
Yes, how would you describe, without going into a circle, because to say that an egg yolk tastes a little custardy is, of course, to say that custard tastes a little eggy.
Yeah, exactly. But maybe with a touch of butter. I think it is something that either takes on other embellishments that tickle your fancy or binds the other things on the plate. So that yolk, particularly if it's runny, sort of almost becomes like a self-sourcing element of your dish, doesn't it? Adds a richness and a thickness to things and a sense of comfort.
This, of course, applies particularly to chicken eggs. Other eggs.
Other eggs are available.
Can be more significantly more flavoursome.
Duck egg is the one that people often say is, I guess, a richer flavour. I have a bit of a, personally, again, I think this comes back to that idea of eggs being a really personal experience, is that the big eggs freak me out a little bit. we've got a producer in the UK called Clarence Court, who at various times will do ostrich eggs and things like that, and they're just so big, aren't they? And they are very rich. I don't know whether... I think a duck egg will stand up to things like truffle and cream and mushrooms because it's so rich in and of itself. But then you get to a certain point and you just think, I've had my fill there. I think I need a coffee.
We've talked a bit about eggs and many of the situations in which we've discussed them has been in that sort of breakfast setting. But to go to the origins of this book, you're arguing for an expanded role.
I think so. I mean, it's either an expanded role of breakfast or just the fact that eggs can be eaten absolutely at all times of day and can be, should be, the star of the dish, the reason to cook it. So we started at the top talking about how it's this amazing ingredient, and most cookbooks or even egg books will be showing it off as an ingredient. So there'll always be a chapter on custard or cakes and stuff like that. But mine is purely, here's an egg, here's how to embellish it. And some of the things in there, there's about 100 or more ideas. Some of them are literally just, oh, that looks like a good embellishment. So I'll go and grab the chili oil rather than the ketchup this morning for my fried egg. But as you say, some of those things could be much more like a meal, a quick meal in the evening, whether that's a baked egg dish, huevos rotos, which is a Mallorcan dish of boiled potatoes. That's a good family favourite for me and always goes down well with my kids.
There must have been a significant research, of course, around putting this together. I mean, what surprised you in this world tour of egginess?
I mean, I ate a lot of eggs.
Human Paul Newman.
Yeah.
I can eat 50 eggs.
Nobody can eat 50 eggs.
I think, I don't know if anything surprised me, but one thing that you could definitely say is that I think you'd struggle to find a country that doesn't say that they have an egg or multiple eggs that are theirs. My cookbook's got probably about a third of it is essentially global classics, which could be as simple as the French Eggs Benedict, but then we can go off all around the world with, I really like one from Uganda called the Rolex, which sounds is spelt like the watch, but actually is rolled eggs, said quickly. And so it's sort of like a quick omelette on a flat base with the chapati paste on top, and then that's rolled up with a few bits and pieces within it, and some cabbage and some peppers and some chili oil. Mexico's amazing for eggs. I went there this summer, actually, and they could rightly say that they must be one of the top sort of five eating countries of eggs, certainly, and probably at least one of their dishes, I think, would be in my top five. Divorciados, divorced eggs. One half is covered with one type of salsa, green salsa, and one half is covered with a red salsa. And then there's it coming, you know, bringing this back to Britain, an egg that I don't think many or any people eat here, but they should, is something called buck rarebit, which is, do you know Welsh rarebit? That, but with a poached egg on top. So cheesy, stouty Worcestershire sauce and the cheese top of the bread, and then some molten yolk spilling out over it onto it.
Did the book enhance your affection for the egg or somewhat satisfy that urge?
I still eat them. I enjoy the kind of fridge and store cupboard challenge of making a different egg every weekend. So in short, I think it's made me love them even more.
Ed Smith, food writer and author of Good Eggs, over 100 cracking ways to cook and elevate eggs. So, we covered fried, poached and scrambled eggs there, but what about boiled? Ed's book does have some recipes, but my impression is that boiled eggs have fallen out of favour recently. Dippy eggs and bread soldiers aren't quite the daily staple that they used to be. Perhaps it comes down to how difficult it can be to get the exact consistency that you're after in a boiled egg, especially when the heat required for the perfect yolk and the perfect white are not necessarily aligned. Back in the early 2000s, the pioneer of molecular gastronomy, Hervé Tisse, came up with the 6X method, slow boiling an egg at around 65 degrees Celsius to the point that the white coagulates but not the yolk. The trouble is, it takes around an hour to cook. More recently, a group of Italian scientists have turned their minds to this conundrum with promising, if not slightly complicated, results.
The cooking of an egg is basically a problem of energy transfer.
Emilia Di Lorenzo is a materials and food scientist at the University of Naples.
So you have a material that is in a high temperature environment, and heat is transferred from the outside to the inside. We can work from the outside on this energy transport problem by changing the boundary condition. So to be able to build a desired thermal profile inside the egg.
A desired thermal profile. Okay. But what does that mean in practical terms?
The method is very simple. You just take the egg, you put it in boiling water, in cold water, and you go back and forth. But what's behind it, it's very scientifically based. We used a computational fluid dynamics program, and we had to find ourselves the parameters of interest, which are heat capacity, thermal conduction, densities, and of course, probably the most difficult part was to find the gelation kinetics of both parts.
The gelation kinetics, of course, referring to the liquid albumin and yolk becoming gel-like. So far, it sounds perhaps a bit too complicated for home cooking. Here's the study's co-author, Ernesto Di Maio.
You have to be an engineer to do this. I mean, you have to be precise. So we check for the temperature and we renovate it when it's too warm after a few drops of the egg from the boiling water. Nothing that a robot cannot do, however.
Okay, simple enough for a robot. So let's accept that it can be done. But the real question is, how does it taste?
Well, I think Ernesto is the best person to answer to this question.
Emilia doesn't like eggs. When I asked her to perform this study, I didn't know, of course.
I have tasted once, and I can say that the yolk is something different to any yolk I have tried before. But I am not a fan of eggs, so maybe I'm not the best person to answer to this question.
No matter. The eggheads brought in the foodies, assembling a panel of tasters who broadly agreed that, yes, the so-called periodic egg pips the famous 6X egg when it comes to sweetness of the yolk, the umami of the white, and the overall flavour. And in just half the time, instead of 60-plus minutes of cooking time, the periodic egg only takes 32. From ABC Radio National, you're listening to an egg-shaped episode of Every Bite.
I mean, this is the wonderful thing about the egg. You couldn't get a simpler object. You know, it's a very beautiful and elegant and simple object. And I think because of its simplicity and because of its strangeness, you know, it holds life within its delicate shells. It's really inspired writers and mystics and artists, you know. So it's sort of in many ways, it's a kind of blank slate that many ideas can be projected onto. My name's Jennifer Higgy, and I'm an Australian writer who lives in London. And I wrote the introduction to the Gourmand's beautiful book on the egg. And I mainly looked at the sort of relationship between eggs and art, which is a very rich one.
And the relationship between eggs and the spiritual realm, Jennifer, tell us about this idea of the cosmic egg as a source of all creation.
Yeah, well, it's such an interesting story. I mean, this creation story of the cosmic egg, it's been around for thousands of years, and it's a recurring theme in many societies across the world. You know, in some ways, it's quite a literal idea. You know, it's the idea that the world, which you could say is sort of like a round egg, was hatched by a greater power. And I think it was first written down in around 1500 BCE, and it was in Sanskrit, actually. And but it was also in origin myths in Australia and China and Greece and in the Persian Empire. It's obviously a story that a lot of people responded to, and it became part of people's sort of origin myths.
Representationally, for the visual artist, is it a difficult form to capture, do you think?
No, well, actually, I remember when I was at art school in Canberra in the late 80s, and I remember we had to draw eggs in our still life and life drawing classes, and they were surprisingly difficult to get right, to get that volume and the smoothness and the sense of the shell. But a lot of great artists have done eggs. I mean, eggs have appeared in art across the globe for centuries.
Do we have, I mean, are there distinct moments artistically? Is the egg more popular in particular cultural settings or in particular periods of art than others?
Well, I mean, that's a good question, but it has been fairly consistent in its sort of manifestation in cultures that use representational forms. And I think one of the earliest representations, well, one of the most famous anyway, is in Pompeii. And there's a very beautiful still life with eggs, birds and bronze dishes. And it's in the house of Julia Felix. So that's Pompeii. So that was around, you know, 50 BCE. And, you know, you can still see that today. And then from then on, you've got eggs appearing in Renaissance art. You've got it appearing actually even before that in sculptural form in Egyptian art. You've got it then being used as an ingredient in art as well, which I think is really interesting. In the 19th century, one of the first popular forms of photography used albumen silver, which used egg in it. And in the Renaissance, egg was used in tempera painting because of its sort of binding qualities. So it's a multifunctional ingredient.
It's often simply represented in art as food, which leads me to wonder how eggs are most commonly prepared in art as a foodstuff.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are many baskets of eggs across the history of art. But then, you know, you've got some really extraordinary paintings by Velázquez, for example, who painted his maid cooking some eggs. And later on, you've got, actually, fried eggs are pretty popular. But then you've got the egg dangling above, say, the Madonna, so as a sign of fertility as well. So, you know, it was, again, it was both food and it was symbolism. That is one of the most famous paintings from the sort of earlier Renaissance, and it's by Piero della Francesca, and it's called the Brera Madonna. And it's a really extraordinary painting. You see the Madonna, and she has this extremely serene face, and she's praying, and she has the Christ child on her lap, and she's surrounded by apostles and people from history. But then above her, on a very delicate sort of golden chain, is quite a small egg that is just sort of hovering there.
Is it often an erotic item in art?
It, you know, the thing about art is that you can never reduce it to one meaning, and that whoever's looking at it will have a different reaction to it. But there was, you know, in the iconography of, say, Renaissance painting or sort of slightly later 18th and early 19th century painting, there was this repetition of this idea that broken eggs might be referring to the idea of a girl losing her virginity. You know, you'll see a sobbing servant girl next to a basket of broken eggs. And so, you know, you can draw your own conclusions from that.
The egg also has its place in architectural thinking.
Yes, 20th century architects especially became very inspired by the sort of minimalism of the egg and its metaphorical potential. And I think most famously, the Japanese architect Tadao Ando's 1995 convention center, it really swells with the form of an egg. Again, it seemed to be popular in Japan because in 2017, his compatriot Shigeru Ban, he completed a huge auditorium in Paris, and that's an ovoid-shaped building. And then there were, you know, various other architects too who were really fascinated by the sort of architectural potential of the egg.
As you say, I mean, that idea of it as the minimal object, perhaps this is the sort of something about the essential notion of minimalism, that it's both nothing and everything. It's
absolutely, yeah. And I think that that's why it's been used so much in religious imagery. I mean, you've got, you know, wonderful artists like the Canadian artist Agnes Martin, and she's, you know, very well known for her extremely minimalist sort of grid-like paintings and drawings. But she was a Buddhist, and one of the few famous works of hers that actually alludes to an object is from 1963, and it's called The Moment Egg. And it's got her trademark minimal lines, but it emerges as a very beautiful egg. So it's a sort of almost like a Buddhist meditation in a way, that there is no beginning and that there is no end.
It's the nature of the egg. It's interesting, though, that in art it is always the egg and seldom the chicken.
This is very true. Well, I'm not being cynical, I think, here, but it is much harder to paint a chicken than an egg.
Which came first, the chicken or the egg?
you'll have to ask wiser people than I for that one.
Aristotle thought that the right response to the riddle is neither the chicken nor the egg, because there's an infinite past and there's always been chickens. And there's always been eggs. I'm Roy Sorensen. I'm a professor at the University of Texas at Austin and interested in philosophical puzzles. And we'll take those puzzles wherever they pop up.
The chicken and the egg, Roy. At what point did human thinkers first express that puzzle?
They were certainly thinking about it before Aristotle. So Aristotle's able to talk about it like an old pro. This theory that there's an infinite past is a pretty lovely theory, in that you solve all these problems about origin. And so it was revived periodically. And in the 20th century, it was championed by Fred Hoyle. This was called the steady state hypothesis by the time he got a hold of it. Incidentally, it was inspired by a horror flick that he and his buddies went to, in which there was a kind of a circular plot going on. Anyway, it's an interesting way that physicists can get their ideas. And he was the one that came up with the term Big Bang when this alternative got going from George Gamow. And so he was trying to shoot down that theory. But in the end, he was the one that was shot down. Right now, the steady state hypothesis, for all its beauty, is not in vogue.
I presume the Big Bang was accompanied by a small litter of eggs, but we may never know.
Now you've got that problem again with the demise of the steady state hypothesis.
What happens when the Old Testament intrudes into this conversation with its idea of creation?
If there are different creation stories in the Bible, The one that's very distinctive and the one that's most difficult to make sense of is the one that, right at the first, it leads off in the beginning, you know, there's just sort of nothing and then boom, there's God.
So that God of the creation would have simultaneously made chickens and eggs, thus resolving our problem.
Yeah, so I think that was the commentary of early church fathers who started to think about, like, well, if Adam comes in, I mean, there's grass growing. So there has to be, things have to kind of look normal so that they keep on progressing along in a regular way without interference and constant tending. They were thinking of the species as being permanent too. Once you raise the possibility that some of them go out of existence, then you can also wonder how they got into existence. And that creates problems again. So now you're back looking for another solution to the chicken and egg problem.
Darwin rather shifts the dial on this, does he not? I mean, he suggests this possibility of evolution, of things changing.
Yeah, so actually it's an old idea that the Greeks had thought of, but no one had kind of documented and given the detail. So there's like 27 different versions of this evolutionary theory that comes back from a long time ago, but they're all vague and they don't have the scholarship that Darwin brought. And so once again, he is now raising this question which came first, the chicken or egg? He doesn't have an answer to this because he has a poor theory of inheritance. He doesn't know how you get your traits. At the time, the one influential theory is by Lamarck, and Lamarck thought that the way that species would change is through use. So giraffes keep on stretching their necks, and eventually they long enough necks, and they're now giraffes. You know, that before they were kind of pre-giraffes. If that were the case, then the answer would be that the chicken came first. It's only with Mendel that you get a better theory. So according to Mendel, once you are a chicken, you cannot change from being a chicken. You're stuck being a chicken for the rest of your life. However, when you're reproducing, there can be a shift. And so what that implies is that the transition must have come from pre-chicken that laid an egg, which was a chicken egg. And I think that is the correct solution to the riddle. And so it's really thanks to Mendel's theory of inheritance when combined with Darwin that you get a correct theory.
Well, that's one of humankind's most enduring ontological quandaries resolved. Enduring because the egg is both symbolic and delicious, a wonder of metaphor and gastronomy. I guess that's what gives it its eggs factor. Every Bite is your weekly journey to the places where food, culture, science and history collide. Every bite tells a story. Thanks to our guests, Ed Smith, Amelia DiLorenzo, Ernesto De Mayo, Roy Sorensen and Jennifer Higgy. Jennifer contributed to coffee table book The Gourmand's Egg. She's also written for a brand new volume, The Gourmand's Mushroom. I hope you've been enjoying these highlights from Every Bite's past. New episodes, well, they are right around the corner. We're beavering away even as we speak. But summer, it's a great time to revisit some old favourites. What are your favourite episodes of Every Bite from the year just past? Share them with a friend. Please pop a link in an email or post an ep on social media or just bring it up in idle chat. I, for one, love these deep dives into single ingredients. An egg. Who knew? Every Bite. It's made on Wurundjeri country and produced by Kim Majerik. I'm Jonathan Green.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.